to WNHH Radio's High Haven program about everything Jewish in our community. I'm your host, Paul Bass, and we have Melanie Wainick here today. She's a leader in keeping our community educated from generation to generation. For the past 5 years, I got that right, she's been at the helm of one of our local Jewish day schools, Ezra Academy, and she has infused it with new life and new energy. Welcome to the studio, Melanie.
Thanks for having me.
You just had your fifth graduation. You oversaw as the principal, right?
Yes.
We don't call you principal. Isn't there a different name?
Head of school.
Now, how did that ever happen? When did we start calling principals head of school?
It really is an independent school construct.
Okay. Is that from a long time ago, or is that modern era?
I would say that it is. It came from the headmistress and headmaster, and then evolved into head of school.
So people didn't want to use those names. It sounded kind of yicky or old-fashioned or something.
Yeah, a little
sexist. She had a different theory. I thought that there was some school where some principal got elbowed out, but got to stay on, and someone else is really running the place. They called him a head of school. I guess not. No, conspiracy theory doesn't work in this case.
No conspiracy theories.
Shucks. I like when they work out. Okay, so since 2012, you've been running Ezra Academy. And that's right over the border there in Woodbridge, B'nai Jacob.
That's a lot
of students from New Haven's Jewish community and actually the whole region. And why did you take the job? It's a K-8 school. What made you want to become a principal of that school?
Well, I've always been committed to Ezra. I have three grown children who attended. And many years ago, I was chairman of the board of directors, and I also led the education committee. I took a break from professional education and spent a few years at home with my kids, and then I went back and got a PhD in education, actually what we call is an EDD. And I had finished, just defended, and Ezra had been looking for a head of school. And they came to me. I wasn't actually looking for the job. And for some reason, I said yes. I can't tell you it was something I had ever anticipated doing.
Well, often the people who do great leadership are the ones who are recruited rather than the ones who have the whole Harry S. Truman phenomenon.
So I will say Sidney Perry did a lot of arm twisting for those.
She's good at that.
Right. She was at the time the executive director of the Jewish Federation of New Haven.
And she would care because Jewish day schools are important to our community. Having an institution that educates young people and their tradition and gets them ready sometimes for Jewish communal life or just to understand the values they grow up with. That's essential to keeping our community going from generation to generation.
It really is. And all the studies that have been done on children that attend Jewish day schools attest to the fact that these are the kids who become leaders in their communities, and not just as adults, but become leaders in their teenage years, on college campuses. So it's hugely important to grow those kinds of children in every community.
Now, that's interesting in comparison to another set of studies I've heard about, but not actually read, so maybe it's apocryphal. Which is that kids will go to Hebrew school, and that's different from a Jewish day school. Jewish day school, like Ezra, that's your school.
That's right.
You go there, kindergarten, first grade, eighth grade. You're there all day. You're learning secular studies, meaning English, math, geometry, that kind of stuff, science. And you're also, half your studies are in Judaics, Hebrew language, Jewish history, ritual practice, prayers. And that's different from Hebrew school or religious school, which is what I and a lot of people grew up with, which is when after you go to your regular school, you go a couple times a week and on Sunday morning to Hebrew school, which is important, and
right,
they're great. But when we grew up in the 60s and 70s, a lot of people had bad experiences with that. I remember a headline when Joe Lieberman ran for vice president, the Jewish Forward had a headline, "He liked Hebrew school!" exclamation point, with the joke being that people couldn't stand it. And I couldn't stand it, even though I loved being Jewish as a kid. We didn't have a lot of it in my home, and you're just so wiped out from the day. You want to watch TV or run around.
Right.
Or play
I think
ball.
That's a huge problem, is that you're really trying to do something after a full day of school.
Actually, the studies I'd heard, and tell me if these are wrong, is that if you went to Hebrew school as opposed to Jewish day school, you were less likely than other Jewish kids to remain Jewishly observant when you grow up.
That's correct. The one factor that has the most influence, and it's just slightly ahead of day school, is Jewish summer camps. Mm. So those kids who attend Jewish summer camps have the highest likelihood of remaining practicing Jews, followed by day schools.
Because they get something there that I only discovered in my adulthood, is how much fun it is to be Jewish. I mean, when you're with a lot of people and you're doing the singing prayers after dinner on Friday night, or just, you know, connecting with nature, or just learning about your religion and practicing it in a fun way, you don't always learn that in our day when we were kids, you know?
So I think that that's the one thing that day schools and camp offer children. It's not an independent part of who they are, but it's an integral part of who they are. So they learn to incorporate Judaism into their lives. They learn to live Jewishly. And when it's a joyous experience, clearly that's something that you want to keep with you and continue to do.
And there's a rhythm to your life. So,
right.
You know, there's certain days that you don't go to work or school because it's a holiday like Sukkot or Simchas Torah, that if you're in that's just part of your rhythm. Your life is different if you're living in a secular kind of environment.
Right. And one of the things that you may not know about is that at Ezra, we have now integrated Judaic studies into the secular studies and vice versa.
That's a great idea.
So instead of teaching, as in some day schools and in the old days, you would have a half a day of secular studies and a half a day of Judaic studies, particularly in the lower grades, kindergarten through fifth grade, we teach thematic units, and the Judaic studies and even Hebrew are all integrated so that the learning is not seen as separate. Mm-hmm. It's seen as part and parcel of who we are, how we learn, and how we see the world.
What would be an example of a class where you'd be integrating them, let's say in second grade or kindergarten or fourth?
So I'll give you, kindergarten is a really easy example, and it's one I love to use because I think it really illustrates the point. So there are two teachers in every classroom, a Judaic teacher and a secular teacher, and they work as a team. Last year, our K-1, we have multi-age classrooms, studied insects. So we ordered ladybug larvae, and the children watched the ladybugs grow and develop and kept logs on what they were seeing. So how do you integrate that into Judaic studies? There is a children's book written in Hebrew where the gist of the book is how the ladybug gets its spots. And something I didn't know but learned through my K-1 students is that as ladybugs mature, they get spots. They're not born with them. So the gist of the story is the ladybug goes to God and says, God, how do I get my spots? And God says, every time you do a mitzvah or a good deed or follow a commandment, I will give you a spot. And so the ladybug goes through a series of mitzvot in order to get her spots. So a beautiful way of connecting a story, which is developmentally appropriate for a 5 or a 6-year-old, that connects to the idea of mitzvah, that connects to the idea of ladybugs growing into their spots. And then, of course, each of the children pretended they were ladybugs. They drew enormous ladybugs with wings that opened and closed. And on the inside of their ladybug, they wrote what they would do if they were a ladybug, the mitzvot that they would do to get their spots.
That's amazing.
So a beautiful...
Makes me want to go back to kindergarten. But also, I mean, so you're learning art, you're learning serious science.
Right.
You're learning Hebrew. You're learning about our religion when you're talking about the importance of doing mitzvot and how you live your life every day and how there are consequences to that. That's beautiful.
So if you look at a more advanced way of doing an integrated study. A couple of years ago, when our eighth graders were learning genetics in their life science class, they read the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is a story about, it's nonfiction, and it's a story about an African-American woman in Baltimore who had several genetic conditions. Without her permission or without her knowledge, her DNA was harvested. And the reality is her DNA has become the basis of genetic study globally. And her family did not find out about it until much, much later. So it's a book about genetics. It's about science, but it's also about ethics and morality.
And values, yeah.
So our kids read the book in science, but they also read the book in rabbinics. And what they talked about was everything from the development of the study of genes and what that's been able to provide medically for all of us as humans. But they also talked about the Tuskegee. In the jails in Tuskegee, patients were inoculated or not for venereal disease studies without their permission or knowledge, and how that became law in this country, medical law that arised out of that study, what impact it had on medical studies going forward, and then the ethical and moral component of it, and what would the rabbis have to say about this type of situation. So again, you know, really taking the Jewish aspects of learning and integrating it into everything that we do. How do we see the world? How do we make decisions? And I think that that's really the power of that kind of learning.
And we're talking about that kind of learning on High Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Our guest is Melanie Wainick, who's just completed her fifth year running Ezra Academy, one of the great Jewish day schools in our community. When I was listening to you talk right now, I was thinking about stories you've written about New Haven Public Schools, this whole idea of integrative education. I mean, it's clearly where a lot of good ideas are percolating in it around in modern education. So in New Haven, there are a couple of schools like Columbus Academy, Clinton Avenue, where they have a dual language curriculum.
That's right.
And they teach classes in both Spanish and English. It's sometimes hard to find the teachers, which I know it is also sometimes with the Hebrew-speaking teachers. And what I found is that it's not just the Latino families, the English second language learners who come. A lot of the English-speaking, non-Latino students also like it, and their parents. They feel like it's a great way to learn, that you're learning Spanish and English at the same time you're learning science or literature.
So our kids start learning Hebrew in kindergarten and take it through the eighth grade. And we have many purposes for doing that. Clearly, Hebrew is the language that all of the important Jewish texts have been written in. But it's also the modern language of the Jewish people. It's spoken in Israel. Our children do go to Israel at the end of their eighth grade experience for 2 weeks. So we're really looking at providing them with the opportunity of becoming able to read, interpret, and wrestle with Jewish texts.
They're so good at that. I mean, as I said, my kids went there. They graduated in 04 and 07, if I have the years right. And what struck me there, and then when I was at your graduation last week, and I know some of those kids, it struck me again, is how much you teach them to be independent, critical thinkers. And that's different from all religions in the way some people run those schools. You're taught to question, you're taught to think for yourself, you're taught to synthesize ideas and defend a position. And they were so good at that. I mean, Jews are good at arguing anyway, but I mean, but it's a kind of pluralistic. I mean, it's a conservative day school, but you have people of all backgrounds. And, you know, my daughter's feminist, had feminist teachers there. You're taught to question, including the precepts of religion. One of my favorite, at the graduations at Ezra Academy in eighth grade, the kids each make a speech, which is fun. You know, they have to stand up and say something, and they work on it. And I was thinking of some of my favorite ones over the years when I was sitting 2 years the other night. And there was one kid who was a friend of our family who, this was about, you know, 15 years ago, whatever. And he gets up, and he thought he was making a really naughty speech. He got up, and he started talking about how, well, to tell you the truth, he's not sure he believes in God. And he talks about he wrestled with the questions. And he had no idea how much every parent was cavilling in that room, thinking that's what it means to be Jewish. He's not supposed to go up there and be a robot. But you actually wrestle with the tradition, wrestle with the ideas, and think for yourself. Which I thought was one of the hallmarks of that school.
It absolutely is. And I think, you know, we have a concept in Judaism of chavruta study, which means when you study a text, it's much more powerful to do it with someone. It's unusual to study alone. And the reason you study with someone is that we each bring ourselves to the table when we look at any kind of text. And it's the same thing with reading a novel. And we will perceive text differently. We will form different opinions. I always talk about chavruta study as being something we do in every subject area at Ezra. So for instance, if you take math, our younger children use a program called Singapore Math. It comes from Singapore. And what's the program about? It's about multiple problem-solving strategies. It's about developing a mathematical language and learning to problem-solve in multiple ways. You will just as readily see a 7-year-old working with another 7-year-old solving a simple algebraic equation and arguing about which strategy is the best one to use.
That's interesting.
As you would 7th graders looking at a rabbinic text and arguing about what the meaning of it is. And I think it's it's Chevruta study has so many applications, but it's that type of study that makes children articulate. It makes them think critically about everything, and it makes them able to parse out what's important, what isn't, what works for them, and what doesn't work for them. And so it's an educational process that we use throughout the school. So you'll see very few individual desks in our school. Most of the kids sit at tables, and it's a very strategic way of setting things up. Even our middle school math class has tables that have whiteboard tops, and they're there for a reason, because when we have kids solving problems, we have them solving them on the table side by side so that they can actually look at one another's work, share their strategies, and talk about why it works or it doesn't.
Seems like you put a lot of thought into how to move this school into a new generation. I mean, not all that stuff was happening. My kids went there back, you know, long ago. It was a great school, and the teachers were great and nurturing and challenged them. They did some stuff to talk about, but I don't remember it at this level. A lot's happened in the last 10 years.
Huh? Yes.
So the school's been around 50 years, correct?
Right. Actually, this is our 51st year.
So that's tough to keep a school like that going. And we'll talk about that in a moment, the challenges of Jewish education. And what I remember is when you came 5 years ago, I remember hearing a lot of, because my kids were long gone, I remember hearing a lot of concerns in the community that not enough kids were enrolling. It was hard. You know, it costs money, you know, to run a school and to have, you have great teachers. And you, in the 5 years, I've heard a lot about how energy has come back, enrollment has come back up. I guess from what you're saying now, you're clearly doing a lot more with education, including Judaics. When you came, what were the challenges and how did you meet them?
I think that the community, in some respect, had lost confidence in the school. And I'm not really sure what all of the reasons were. You're absolutely right. This community is not a community of tremendous wealth. Public schools are, in some places, really quite good. And private school is expensive. And we are not Westchester, we're not Chicago or Los Angeles. So that kind of wealth doesn't exist here.
There's also the math question. We have 130,000 people in New Haven, we have a couple hundred thousand people in the whole region. We're not in a metropolitan area of millions with millions, you know, with hundreds of tens of thousands of Jews, right?
Right.
So it just aren't. So my theory on it from the outside was that, yeah, some Jewish parents will always complain about education. You send them to the best school in the world, which I did when my kids went to Ezra. And there were always parents there complaining like it was the end of the world, that there wasn't this happening with enrichment. And all I could do was sit back and think, have they seen other schools? I mean, they don't know how lucky they have that their kids are here. So while I'm sure what you said is true about losing confidence, I had analyzed it as a numbers question. When you have so few people to choose from, and you just have a few families, because it's such a hard decision about where to send your kid to school. It's not always the same right decision for each kid. You have
right.
to throw your guilt aside about what you owe society. Your kid comes first. And for some kids, like my kids went to public school at the beginning and then in high school, and that was right for them. It was right for them to go to Ezra when they went. But if you just have three or four families who are Jewishly involved, but it really makes sense for them to send their kids to Edgewood School or Cold Spring School, all of a sudden you have a threat to the survival of Ezra, because they're just, all of a sudden you don't have enough kids there.
Well, I think the other issue too is that New Haven's Jewish community is an aging community.
Right. That's part of what I meant by the numbers.
Right.
That so it takes very few individual family decisions to determine how many kids are going to be in a class.
Right. So look, you know, there are a lot of, you know, several years before I came, we had a huge economic downturn. That also has an enormous effect. And it didn't just have an effect on Ezra. In fact, private schools all over the country are still feeling the result of that. So it is not just an Ezra problem. But I think in many ways, I feel like I was given a gift. I had just...
And a challenge.
And a challenge.
And because you had spent so many years as a parent on the board, you were invested in the place. They recruited you to say, hey, Melanie. And I remember just hearing, because I'm close to a lot of people who are involved with the school, I remember hearing all the good things that were happening as soon as you were coming, that like, this place is still gonna make
so,
it.
So, you know what? Look, I'm local. I know all the players. That's a huge leg up on the learning curve. I was invested in the school both emotionally and because of long-term commitment. And I had just finished a number of years of thinking very, very deeply about education.
I was wondering about that when you said back, because you'd been a teacher before, correct?
Right.
I wonder what motivates a person to go back to get the equivalent of a PhD in education after their kids are grown up. Where was that going to take you? Was that to take you to the next level professionally, or do what you just said to think more about education and apply new research and thinking time to how you carry it out?
So for me, it had always been a goal that I had put on hold. And I did it slowly because I was raising three kids at the same time and I was going to Columbia. So it was a bit of a schlep. For me, it was sort of both. I mean, I was looking to go back into the education world. I wasn't 100% sure of what that meant. But it did give me the opportunity to think for a long time about what I thought schools should look like. So when I came to Ezra, I had a vision in my head of what I thought a fantastic school should look like.
So that was the opportunity, the gift you were given. Here's a school that has a great community, a great history, but it's having trouble having enough kids to run. It needs some new energy, some new ideas. And you said, now I'll come in and try to put mine in place. What were some of those ideas?
Well, I came to the board, the search committee, and I said to them, you need to know what you would get if you hire me. I'm a progressive educator. What does that mean? So progressive education, for those who don't know, is really a movement that started with John Dewey in the late 1800s. And he took the model of the one-room schoolhouse and thought about what was successful there. And what was successful? Multi-age classrooms, kids of different ages together, schools and classrooms being a reflection of society. And for Dewey, that was democratic society. Hands-on learning. So integrated curriculum, those are all things that I really believe very strongly in. So when I went to the board, I said to them, these are the things I believe in. These are the things I would like to implement. I think they work beautifully within a Jewish day school context. And they said, go for it.
We talked earlier about integrated education. You gave some great examples of the ladybugs and about... What are some examples of those other ideas you're going to bring and how you added that to the way the school operates?
So we have always done it. I'm sure you remember in fifth grade, there's an enormous unit on ancient Egypt. It's sort of it's one of those things that kids remember for a lifetime. So now we do it with the fourth and fifth grade. And we don't just learn about ancient Egypt. We start by talking about archaeology. How do we learn about the ancient past? We bring in the Connecticut State Archaeologist. Most people don't know that Connecticut has an archaeologist. Yeah. If you're building a house and you're digging a foundation and you come across anything that might have archaeological significance, you have to stop, call in the state archaeologist, and before you can continue, it's just like digging for sewer pipelines. Just like in Israel, they do this.
Can you dig anywhere in Israel and not come across an archaeological
probably not.
Significant find?
So we start there. We've always had our contacts at the Peabody Museum. The kids are taken behind the scenes to look at relics. Rabbi Ben Skolnick, who is a rabbi in Hamden, has actually participated in many archaeological digs in Egypt, looking for evidence of the Exodus. He will come and speak to the kids.
What's his conclusion, by the way?
I think that he thinks there is some evidence, but he would be an amazing person for you to interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we can do anything as simple as taking a giant chocolate chip cookie. So here we're going to integrate math into archaeology. And the kids are each given a piece of graph paper, and they have to graph where all of these chocolate chips are on the graph paper. And then they have to excavate them with a toothpick, trying not to break them because we don't want to break our pottery. And they are feeling very successful when they're finished. And the teacher says to them, okay, everybody, turn your cookie over. And lo and behold, there's a whole nother layer of chocolate chips. So what happens in archaeology? Archaeologists learn that when they are digging, it happens in layers. So again, very simple. But then we go into the study of ancient Egypt. At the same time, studying the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot, in their text study. And at the same time, in science, we mummify chicken legs. And the kids in math weigh and measure those chicken legs every day. and keep graphs of what happens to mummified flesh. They may study river deltas because the Nile was a delta that was settled by the ancient Egyptians. Where else in the world do those river deltas occur? What's happened through history? They built irrigation tools that the Egyptians used, and our fourth and fifth graders have Teva Tuesdays, which is every Tuesday they study nature and ecology and environmentalism. They spend 3 hours outdoors, so they took their ancient Egyptian tools and used them outside to transfer water from a nearby stream, just the way the Egyptians did. So there are so many things that can be done.
This is just bringing back this flood of memories to me of all the memorable year-by-year study units the kids have. I remember my kids building engineering a real bridge out of very fine wood,
right,
and that still stands up in our house, their bridges. Or the year Mrs. Gell, who was a longtime, I guess, English teacher, she taught them how to write clearly in directions, and it was about a peanut butter sandwich.
Oh, that was in third grade.
She would ask people, how do you make a peanut butter sandwich? And she'd have act out the directions they give you after you write them. Say, put the peanut butter on the bread. And so she'd get a jar of peanut butter and place it on top of the bread. You say, no, you're supposed to take a knife, put the peanut butter on the knife, and then spread it on the bread. They learned so many great things at Ezra Academy. And you're hearing about Ezra Academy from Principal Melanie Wainick here on High Haven WNHH Radio, a program about everything Jewish in our community. So, Melanie, how'd it go in those 5 years? How did you bring the school back and take it into a new century?
So I think the key to change is to do it slowly and to do it well. You really have to build confidence by doing things well and by not overwhelming people. So our first year, we started a K-1. And to be honest with you, I overstaffed it. And I overstaffed it with really excellent teachers. The other thing that we did is I pay my teachers to write curriculum over the summer. So we are not so much focused on bringing in outside curricula, but in developing what works well for our community and for our children. That being said, we keep an eye on standards, so the National Science Foundation standards, and those types of things. But really, I think investing our community in our change. The second year, we added a 2-3, then a 4-5. The third year.
So everyone in second grade is in class with someone in third grade?
Correct. So each of those.
Oh, I see. Then you move up. The third graders go to.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
How do you do that? So if you do you learn Egypt for 2 years if you're in three,
No,
four?
There's a 2-year curriculum for each of those multi-age classes. So you never repeat the same.
But if you've gotten the first half in third grade, so then is a 3-4?
Mm-hmm.
So then when you're in fourth.
Sorry, 2-3.
So in the beginning, you'll hear the first half in second grade, then the next year you get the second half, and it doesn't repeat what you had.
No.
So the people learning that part for the first part, you couldn't learn that for the first time that way?
Right. So it's really a series of thematic units. Within those units, there's content that needs to be learned and skills and concepts. But the whole idea is that we meet children where they are, and our expectations for each of them are very individual. So there are always multiple opportunities for learning the same content, the same concepts that are appropriate for where each child is.
And special ed is a challenge at smaller schools like Ezra. I remember when our kids were there, they weren't special ed kids because they didn't have the money really to have special ed teachers. And often public schools feel like it's not fair. They get
That's not the case any longer. We have anywhere between 80 and 90 students at any time. And we employ 2 full-time special educators.
Wow.
The reason we do that is very intentional. We really believe that that Ezra's community should be a reflection of the New Haven Jewish community. And that means that if we can service a child's learning needs, that they have every right to be within our school. And so we have children with educational needs, emotional, social needs, kids that are on the spectrum. If we can provide them with what they need, then we include them in our community as they should be.
Okay. Now, can you walk us through a typical day at K-8 Ezra Academy?
Most days start with some kind of tefillah or prayer.
I'm going to stop you there. That was always the biggest challenge, not only at Ezra, but any school, Jewish school, is that kids hate to pray.
Right. So we've changed that up quite a bit.
So how have you dealt with that?
So every Monday morning, the entire school learns Parsha, the portion of the week that will be read in Torah. And that takes the place of a formal tefillah service.
And traditionally, tefillah is always supposed to include some Torah study, although
correct,
it's done by rote, like here's the passage you read real quick.
Yeah. Correct. So that is done in individual classrooms, but the middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade all do it together. So what it would look like is different. So for a K-1 student, it might just be a narrative, a story. This, by the time you're in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, you may be given a piece of text from the Parsha with questions to respond to. The kids go off in multi-age groups, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. They will translate the text. They will respond to it and then come back together as a community and talk about the difference in responses. On Tuesdays, everyone has a traditional morning prayer service, again, with their cohort. So what's appropriate for a second and third grader may be very different for a 6th, 7th, and 8th grader.
You still have the full school ones. Those were tough,
yes,
to police.
Yes.
Because kids get unruly and things.
Yeah. Well, so then on Wednesdays, we do something called Iyun Tefillah, which is actually learning prayer in terms of looking at the text, understanding it, and again, for the older kids, it becomes a text study. What does the prayer mean? What was the intent of the author? What does it mean to us today? And responding to it. And for the younger children, it's learning recitation, but also meaning. On Thursdays, we have a whole school prayer service, which is completely run by the eighth graders. They take charge, as they've always have. We read Torah. The kids read the Torah themselves. And it's really, because it's only a once-a-week whole school tefillah now, the energy is much more positive
more
than it once was.
And the kids are running.
And the other thing I will tell you is that our Judaic teachers went to an amazing conference this year in St. Louis, which was run by Camp Ramah, and they came home with so much ruach, so much spirit, and so many new tunes that it's really elevated tefillah to a level it hasn't been at in a long time.
That was like one of the, and people, friends of mine who have taught in Jewish education, say everywhere it's the same challenge at every school, every denomination, Orthodox, conservative, getting the kids in prayer and making them appreciate and understand it, but also want to be there is tough. I know that melody is very important for that and understanding,
yes,
the meaning.
Very.
I've also always found that prayer in smaller settings is much more meaningful to me. When I look at a big room and you have, it's kind of hard for everyone to tap in.
Right. So we actually, you may remember, we are housed at B'nai Jacob and they have a large sanctuary and a small chapel.
That is a beautiful chapel. Oh, man.
So we actually have moved to the chapel.
That's good.
We
move.
Do everything there.
Just being there makes you feel great with all stained glass all around.
And it's very intimate.
Eight rows of pews and beautiful arc. Yeah.
And then on Friday afternoons, the school gets together for Kabbalat Shabbat or welcoming the Sabbath. And sometimes we do it as whole school. The other thing that we do is classes are paired for an entire year. So the eighth grade was paired with the fourth and fifth grade. The seventh grade was paired with the second and third grade. And the sixth grade was paired with the K-1 children. That is a relationship that we work at all year. So they get together every other week for Kabbalat Shabbat. They come in and mentor the younger kids. They tutor them before holidays. Particularly Passover, they'll teach the younger kids the four
questions.
That
I'll never forget. The way kids learn Passover at Ezra is amazing. If you've been to any Seder with kids who went to Ezra Academy 10 years ago, 20 years ago, they remember, they have so much to say about every aspect of it. You spend hours talking about the philosophy and they know all how to conduct it. And I guess that's part of the idea of having the older kids teach the younger kids.
Right. And we will even do that in math.
So now, when we were kids, that was called Each One, Teach One. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Where in the 60s, I remember I was in grade school, and that was the new kind of hippie thing. That was the latest thing in education. It was the exact same idea. And
so,
all the kids sat with a young kid and taught him something.
So our fifth graders wrote books in Hebrew. They wrote children's books this year. And they spent an afternoon in the K-1 reading their books to the younger children. It's so empowering for those kids to not only create something, but then to be able to share it in a meaningful way.
Boy, it is amazing how many good things sound like they're going on at Ezra Academy. That's wonderful, Melanie Wainick.
Thank
Congratulations
you.
On everything you've done with the school.
Thanks.
And we went through the whole interview without mentioning that Natalie Portman for 5 minutes attended Ezra Academy as a kid before she moved to New York and became a famous actress. But all the kids who went to Ezra Academy tend to bring that up at some point.
What about David Isay, who's a big guy? He went to Ezra.
But he's not a celeb.
In my world.
Mine too. We're public radio people, but yeah, okay. But anyway, thanks for your radio visit. I really appreciate, Melanie Wainick, that you came on to High Haven today to share with us the good news about Ezra Academy, a K-8 Jewish day school. As a parent, and to this day, grateful, one of the best moves I ever made as a parent my whole life was sending two kids to Ezra Academy. I mean that so deeply. I mean, you look back as a parent, you try to do everything right, and some things are right, some aren't. I have always been so grateful that Ezra Academy was there for my kids with nurturing teachers and a great education and a great grounding in Judaics and a lifelong inquisitive spirit that they helped imbue. I recommend that everybody check out that school. So thanks for coming on, Melanie Wainick. And thanks for listening today in High Haven. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it with us all week long here at WNHH, your home for community radio.